This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. So this morning, I thought it might be a good idea if that, you know, we work together on a koan. I always enjoy participation. So hearing what each of you have to say is so valuable because we all come from different perspectives, different experiences, and certainly have different insights about who we are and the nature of reality. So along with your participation today, we're going to work on Lin Chi's True Man, which is a koan from the Book of Serenity. But before we jump in, I first would like to give a little few tips about koans, just to introduce the subject. But tell me, how many have worked with koans? Oh, good. Few. All right. Well, koans are something that we don't really stress as much in the Soto tradition, but actually Dogen was trained in koans in the Tendai school. And so as we come through in the lineage, we also carry that forward. But the important thing about koans is that they're really about everyday life. They're nothing special, in the sense that it's a reserved sutra teaching. They're really about stories that apply to ourselves. They're there for us to actually investigate and see what all of the symbols and images and metaphors really mean, and how do they apply to us. So when you approach a koan, you really go, sometimes it's easiest if you come in from the conventional understanding of a phrase or an image and then carry that forward into the deeper Buddhist sense of, and how it applies to your life. So we have to do a level of abstraction and say, okay, well, these are about, everyday activities, but then how does it apply to like mental states and mind habits and ways of being? So that's how koans are set up. Koans also have many layered teachings. Some are teachings about what we chanted this morning. You might find excerpts about form and emptiness, or the relative and the absolute, or the universal and the particular, from something from the Heart Sutra. Then there was the harmony of difference and equality that we chanted. And there is often many references to elements of that chant in the koans. So the more familiar you are with some of the Buddhist teachings, the more you can spot them in the koans. And it's another level of helping you penetrate the meaning of the koan and apply it to yourself, because now you have something to anchor your understanding upon. So now I think we're ready to jump into the koan. And Joyce here is going to pass out some of the elements of the koan. So we have the title, the introduction, and the case that we'll cover this morning. But there's actually many more commentaries. And there's a verse. So in the Book of Serenity, there's a lot more to the koan than you might find in some of the other shorter versions of koans. So for us, we're just going to work with the elements here. So with any koan, the first thing we need to do is look at the title and study the title. Generally, Americans like to skip over the title. It's like, let's go skate right through to the meaning of it. Let's get into it. You know, we're going to learn about this koan. But let's pause for a moment and try to figure out who was Lin Chi to begin with. So Lin Chi's, we don't really have his date of birth, but we do have the date that he passed, and it's 866. So we're looking at 9th century. He is a Zen master who has the honor of being the head of the Rinzai school. And many times you may see him pictured with a very fierce look on his face. He's quite gruff and very direct, confrontational, and actually gets quite physical with his students, and would is also known for his shouts. So some of the stories or the cases that are in make up the koans, you may see some of this, you know, bashing, physical bashing, where someone gets hit, you know, on the head with a hoe. Another one might be slapped in the face. And, you know, we're talking student and master, so look out there, Michael. I'm not suggesting anybody should go there, but it is the style that is more pervasive out of the Rinzai school. So Lin Chi is of the succession of masters that started with at least, you know, more recent around his time with Ma Su, and then there was Ma Su, Baijiang, Huang Bo, and then came Lin Chi. So the important thing about Lin Chi is that his teaching is, or he's known for the teaching of the true man of no rank. And his contemporary was Dongshan Lianji, who is very well known for his contribution and the development of the five ranks. It's considered the highest level of koans. And so it's when you put the two and you, you know, face them off, right? I mean, what are we looking at? One of no rank and one of five ranks, right? So we could say that there might have been a little bit of competition among the schools, because Dongshan is a representative. He's the one who is targeted or suggested that he started the Soto school in China. So we have these two Zen masters with the leading the different lineages. So now we have some idea who is Lin Chi. What do we know about the true man? The true man. So the true man of no rank, the five ranks, no true. We often talk more about true self and no self than we talk about the true man. So those words could all be used one in place of another, true self, true man, no self. So you have some idea now of Lin Chi's true man and what the topic might cover. So I think we might be ready now to go into the introduction. Does anybody want to volunteer to read the introduction for us? Y'all have a copy. Okay, John.
(Clears throat) taking a thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master. Can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey's saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master?
Thank you. So taking a thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master. Let's start with just the anybody have any thoughts on the first phrase or the second phrase? What is it? What is taking a thief? What's going on when someone takes a thief for one's son? Yes.
Things don't really appear as they are.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good, yeah. Any other thoughts? Yes, Todd.
Well, a son is quite intimate with whoever it is who's taking it, not just anybody. So the thief is, in a way, transformed a little to something that a person loves.
So you're taking it from the thief going to the son. Is that...
taking a thief for one's son. So if there's a thief here and he turns out to be my son.
Mm-hmm.
I have my relationship with my son, which is about love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Yes, John?
Maybe this is a suggestion that the son and the thief have some equivalence, and there's a diminution of discrimination, and we can accept a thief as one's son in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are no right answers or wrong answers, so, we're just, yes.
Doubts.
Doubts? Mm-hmm. Okay, doubts. All right. Jerry?
Typically you have some experience that you want to recreate. So you go and try to get something that you don't already have.
Mm.
And that kind of an attitude is looking, is making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking outward and taking what you think is really important, your own son. But in fact, it's a thief.
So
I think it's that kind of a mistake. It's pointing to a mistake,
mm-hmm.
which is typically made.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond the particular meaning, I'd like to say that in my own experience, which is very small with koans,
mm-hmm.
it's not a matter of understanding at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not such an intellectual
mm-hmm.
effort. One can't even say it. But the quality is something that you are or become or
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And although these are highly polished
mm-hmm.
Chinese forms and poetry,
mm-hmm.
they come from an extraordinarily highly polished tradition. So, of course, there are allusions to
yes.
aspects of the tradition and fine poetic references to
mm-hmm.
internal states that one might, feelings,
yes.
or situations which might cause an interior kind of a, oh, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's familiar.
Yes.
So that's very interesting,
mm-hmm.
and it can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But the essence of it isn't such an intellectual analysis at all.
Yes, you're accurate in that. And I think it's just a way we're trying to enter into something that appears many times to be somewhat obtuse to many people. So if you start with entering through images and symbols, it's a way to say, okay, well, what's that? now I see it conventionally. Now, how can I also apply it to myself? And in terms of, as you stated, with mental states, I mean, this is about interior work. It's not about being out there. It's all about interior work. We all have to do the work ourselves for our own. No one can awaken for you. So that's the in a sense, the purpose of the koan is to stimulate you to awaken yourself. So how can you begin if you can't understand even the meaning or penetrate it at all? So it's just an entry point. But yeah, did somebody else have a... Yes, Jonathan.
I read it really literally, and taking somebody who wished to steal from you.
Uh-huh.
And giving something instead.
Mm-hmm.
Treating them like a child.
Uh-huh.
Like a child.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I guess.
I take it as a thief is someone who's going to take something that doesn't belong to them for whether they need it or just because they want it. But it's just, then to take them as a son is then to give them everything that you have.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who was going to, at one point, was going to steal from you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I see it both ways. Like, it's a mistake. You know, you thought it was, you're treating someone like your son, but it's a thief. But also the other way, which is, yeah, treat a thief like a son and watch what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes?
I get a sense that a father's love for his son, so maybe this person, the father, wants to express how he can have deep love for somebody that has possibly taken from him. So, and then when you take the second phrase, taking the servant for the master, it kind of, again, the appearances, and you just never know who can be your teacher or what you can learn from a thief. So it's, I don't know, I think it's intertwined with the sort of love you have for everyone,
mm-hmm.
and that it should not be just limited to your son,
mm-hmm.
or the respect for a master should not only be respect mm-hmm. just for that person, but also for the servant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What Jerry said about how these can just elicit an emotional response, I started thinking about that, and it, when I read that phrase, taking a thief for one's son, it sends my mind into this weird mode where it's like hyper-discriminating. Like, is it my son or is it a thief? Is it a son or is it a thief? It's like, try and figure it out, quick. Is it a thief or is it someone I'm supposed to love? And it's like,
mm-hmm.
like really hyper-aware.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a frightening feeling.
Mm-hmm. How about, did you have a comment?
Okay.
I was thinking, too, how have you heard the phrase thief moment? Yeah. A state that you're in, if you're really, very caught in some emotional state or in some idea, about something, how when you're in those states and caught, is that the experience where you're actually away from being present? You're really more in some other mental state as opposed to really being present. If you're really angry or if you're really frustrated or you're really fervent about some idea, you may miss something, and so you may not really be aware of what's going on in the moment because the internal process you're having is very intense, and it's not, it's what we would say you're caught in whatever you're thinking about or experiencing. So you're not really present, and so in a sense, that thief is whatever is that you're thinking about. You know, sometimes we ruminate. And when you ruminate, you get caught, right? So you can't possibly be present. You're, you know, churning over and over the same thoughts about something. And in that sense, those, we could say that's the, you know, the thief that's taking us away from the present, from the present moment. So it's another way you can, you know, view the image of the thief. Yes?
So kind of along those lines, that I like the, it could be one or it could be the other.
Mm-hmm.
Taking an actual thief for your son, or taking your son for a thief, or looking at your... I get accusatory, I can also see myself as a thief.
Mm-hmm.
And I get paid such good money for what work I do, I feel like I'm stealing.
Mm-hmm.
Or I got in front of this guy, I stole his lane, I'm a thief.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, to mm-hmm. catch myself as a thief, I contend with myself as if I were my son. You know, it's like our different parts try to catch and help each other. So these elements could all be internal,
yes.
including this taking the servant as the master,
mm-hmm.
which is not... which may be the appropriate approach to serve and consider that your master.
Yeah. So we do have a tendency to value certain, like masters versus servants, right? I mean, there is this valuing that is, can be part of this notion of preferences. And so we'll value something and undervalue something else. But now we have a servant and we're valuing the servant as the master. And so, you know, it kind of flips us around. But actually, we do this all the time. We value certain things and we put more value on something versus another. And so it's a, you know, it's an issue around preferences and valuing one thing over another. And that too can operate in a way of when we place value on something and devalue another, we're actually moving away from being present, because we've chosen, in a sense, instead of accepting all that is thusness, suchness, we're choosing, picking and choosing, saying one thing's better than the other. Yes.
I don't have the whole story, but I have in my memory a story about my ex-husband who was drafted out of college. And when he was, he was stationed actually up in Washington. And he came out of a hotel one day, he was on leave, and asked this person in a uniform to carry his bag. Turned out it was an officer, mm-hmm. in the army. That's all. That's all it is. I just thought it was hilarious.
Yes. All right. So one teaching that's probably relevant in the context of those two phrases is the Samda Nirmochana Sutra refers to an aspect of mind which is the appropriating mind. And, you know, appropriating mind means that, you know, the mind can grasp something before you even are conscious of it. So it makes it more difficult for us to be really awake to what's really happening in our process. And so it's easy, unless you're really working, hard to see the thief in the mind, how is the thief taking you away from being present, then you can easily go down some mind stream, and before you know it, you're caught into something, whether it's ruminating about something or a feeling or intense feeling or belief. Or, you've kind of missed the opportunity to wake up. So if you know this about human, being human, is that you have this appropriating mind, this aspect of mind that will grasp at things before you can even see them. You can see how much more valuable your practice is to sit and wake up, because sitting helps you begin that awareness process about what's going on in your mind. The more you can see it, then it's easier to stop and see and not get caught, not take the hook, so to speak. So let's see, the next sentence is, it's actually a question, which is kind of early in the introduction, but anyway, can a broken wooden label be your ancestor's skull? Any ideas? Yes.
You said something about sitting.
Yes.
It's not, in my view, it's not beginning to do anything.
Mm.
It's not a matter of process or beginning. When you sit with a full effort, that's it.
Yes.
That's it. There's no beginning to get something at all.
That's correct. Yes. So if there's an effect. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I have a question about the question. Is there some special meaning to ancestor skull? I mean, we don't really, I think in our day, we don't really have ancestor skulls lying around. Is it like,
wow.
Is it special? Does it mean something different to them?
Well, yes, you're on to the, in that era of China, it was culturally important. Ancestor, I don't know if you call it worship, but ancestor honoring is really part of the culture. And so, here you have an ancestor skull in your presence, and yes, you have a broken ladle too, so yes.
Yeah, we're told in Orioki that the big bowl is Buddha's skull.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a common trend.
Mm-hmm.
It seems similar.
So there are containers. A container, it could be a container. A bowl is a container. A skull is a container if it's emptied. So is a broken wooden label at some level, but not very useful. Yes.
I like it's a question where it's like curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, yeah, there could be a lot of honor in everyday items that might be broken.
Mm.
So
it's
looking further than the brokenness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I mean, the thought to me is that if you take away what you use something for or how you interpret it or the meaning that you project into anything, if you strip that away, is there any difference between them at all?
Mm-hmm. Right. They're both empty, yes. Mm-hmm.
I think the ancestor skull is a thing revered in, I think, the Asian cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And what a label might be desired or treasured.
Mm-hmm.
Usefulness. But I think, again, they're comparing one or the other and encouraging us not to discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
Values of those two things to go to unity and not separate them out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, bones are a structural element in a koan and or reference to bones, and this can represent your conditioning. What ways you've been brought up, your belief systems, your family systems, all of that. That makes up, coming from your ancestor, coming forward, all that conditioning. So a donkey's saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. Mm-hmm. What do we know about a donkey? How's a donkey compared to a horse? Mm. And this donkey saddle rim is not even a whole saddle. It's just a rim. And Father's jawbone isn't the skull. It's just a piece, right? So something in here is, I think, John, you had commented about some things being partial. I think there might have been other references too. How this is really only part of, the donkey's saddle rim is part of the saddle. It's not the whole saddle, and the jawbone is just a part of the skull. So somehow, we're being it's suggested or being cautioned to, to wake up that maybe the way we see reality is only in parts. We project onto the whole, but yes.
And there's also a comment here about form, because the shape of a saddle rim and the shape of the jawbone are the same. So you might think there's some similarity, but they're completely different. So I think there's a comment on formlessness as well.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? All right, when breaking earth, separating weeds, how do you discern the master? So here's the question that's to engage us now. Breaking earth. Yes, Joyce.
Well, I'm thinking that I could say this in a different way to say, when you're going through your mundane life, how do you discern your true self? And kind of, it's always difficult because we're always being pulled back and we get caught up in things, and so it's kind of a challenge.
Yes.
I think it's also encouraging us to get out of our bed too. Separating the earth from the reeds and the master, just get it, put that stuff aside. Just look at what's happening here now.
There you go. Right, direct engagement. Yeah, well, separating reeds also probably requires some skill, so it's also saying, use your skills. I mean, when you're in this process, awake. Discernment. So always the last question is a form of engagement to say, okay, come on, let's get in here and let's go take a look. So helping us to do our work. So anybody want to read the case? We have the next section to go through. The case, yeah? Yes, go ahead.
Linji said to the assembly, there is a true man with no rank, always going out and in through portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look. Then a monk came forward and said, what is the true man of no rank? Linji got down from the seat, grabbed and held him. The monk hesitated. Linji pushed him away and said, the true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is.
So Linji didn't disappoint. He was his true self. So you can see that kind of engagement level between master and student. Look. Any thoughts on this one? Yes, Cliff.
It's a little bit reminiscent of Dongshan Koan, where he says, it now is me, I now am not it. So the true man is, he also, Dan Leighton in his book, translated as, he now is me. I now am not him.
Yes, yes. Done.
In the second paragraph there, the monk wants to engage in a discussion. He's intellectual.
Right.
And then she answers him with a piece of dry
crap. Right, so in a sense, if you think about true man being, you know, really, again, we're looking at sacred or valued, and then here we have dried crap. You know, okay, now it's all back on the same playing field, which is, I think, you know, again, we're talking, when we think about preferences and how that can get in the way of our actual direct experience of reality. It separates us because we value something and undervalue another. It's just another way that we just need to wake up to what is really happening. In every moment, you know, we see something arise, and the phrase of the true man of no rank is always coming and going in out of the portals of your face is, I think, a very graphic image that if we're present and seeing what arises and what deconstructs in the next moment, we can start really experiencing the fluidity of our lives, which isn't as fixed as we like to believe life is. We pick and choose, and in our picking and choosing, we actually fragment reality. We say, oh, it's this, or it's that, or it's not this, or it's that. And so in this kind of work, it's also the challenge for us is really to stop and see what is it that we don't see. What is it that we're undervaluing and valuing? What is it that we're experiencing, you know, the thief operating in our mind? When that occurs, are we aware of it? Can you see it? And then, can you stop? Yes.
It seems like value is a continuous theme.
Mm-hmm.
The son and the thief, and the broken ladle and the ancestor skull, kind of a dichotomy of things that we consider worthless and very precious.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know if when he says dry crap, would he have... Dry crap is both, right? It's extremely valuable and it's also discarded.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both the most fertile thing and what we need for our
mm-hmm.
for anything to grow.
Uh-huh.
And also what we
good catch.
Kind of want to stay away from. So
right. Right, no, turning away and touching, right? Same. Mm-hmm.
So would it have been, would he have made the same point if he had just said how worthless he is? Or did he mean dry crap?
You can choose.
Another translation is shit wiping stick.
Right? Yeah,
so
yeah,
I've
shit. Right, yes.
I've never seen dry crap
translated. Yeah, this is Cleary's version. Mm-hmm. Book of Serenity. Right. Yeah, it's it is one of the themes, I think, when you consider also that, you know, what was Lynchy being a thief at that moment? I mean, really, when he grabs the student, is he taking something from the student? You know, there's no individual expression that comes from the student either. So... You know, who's the thief? Who's the, you know. We could say that's, you know, another possibility. Of course, you know, Linchi is has, you know, his teaching style, but, you know, people were aware of it during that time. So you were prepared, I guess. Yes, John.
In the first paragraph there, too, there's a teaching being presented between the true man and the portals of your face, the true man, the nirvana image, and the face, the samsara image.
Mm-hmm.
Here in this floating world of suffering. And he says, they're always going out and in together.
Mm. No difference, right? Mm-hmm. Look. That looked great. Although we, as I said earlier, we can see how we fragment that, what's always coming and going. It's part of what, as humans, we're very skilled at. So in this sense, the you know, koan can turn you. So even when you're working, you know, after we... you know, leave the space, the sacred space, and we're out in the everyday world here. Taking a phrase and, you know, just letting it mull around in your head, you know, just let it see what comes up. Because it's really there for you. The koans turn you and you turn the koan, so it's kind of the experiential emphasis is definitely always with koans. And so while we're talking about it, and in a sense intellectualizing, it's really for you to experience. And it's for you to experience in, you know, how does it come into you? How does it come and express itself within you? That is kind of what I was thinking for this exercise, to help you just not be so removed from considering even this kind of work, or even, you know, poetry. It's another way we access our true self. So maybe we'll leave it at that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.